Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Today, my guest is Deb Matlock, educator, mentor, shamanic practitioner, and principal at Wild Rhythms. How can the field of environmental education be improved? What is humane education? And why should we integrate the more than human voice into our practice? Let's find out. Thank you so much for helping me articulate what independent educators are doing throughout the environmental education field and natural resource fields. Your work is very interesting. If you could introduce yourself to listeners.
Yeah, thank you. So my name is Deb Matlock, and I've been working in the field of environmental education for about 25 years. And in my mind, that I've been doing one job for 25 years. But if you look at my resume and my background, it looks like a whole bunch of different things. But it all points to environmental education and to connecting people to land and wildlife and creating that deeper sense of how we can live on this planet. And so I've done things from work for government organizations to nonprofits to higher education, and also a lot of independent consulting and working as a freelancer, and ultimately starting my own business as well. In addition to that, I try to do a lot of volunteer work for organizations that are supporting environmental education. And I've been on the board. I was the past board president of Colorado Alliance for Environmental Education, and I've been on numerous committees with them over the years, and trying to devote my time to helping the field to become a little bit up-leveled and more professional, and with the idea that not only does that benefit the educators, but it also benefits the people, but also the educators who are trying to make a living in the field.
What could use more attention in the field?
That is a great question. I think one of the things that environmental education faces is, in many cases, a high turnover rate. You know, it's a low-paying field, and it's a high-demand field, and it's a field that attracts people who love and are passionate about what they do. And so all of those things are potential risks for burnout. But if we keep the field developing itself professionally and creating opportunities for people to move careers through the field and you know, finish one project and have something else waiting for them, you know, or another opportunity to go to a higher place in their organization, or more creative opportunities. So if somebody is leading the same program year after year after year, can we be innovative within the field to create inspiring opportunities? And also with that, theoretically, funding opportunities and security and support that go with innovative and cutting edge programming, and provide those a little bit of a safety net. I think the field needs the institutional knowledge of people who start out as seasonal field educators, you know, but stick with it in all the different capacities and, you know, finish their careers there. I think there's a lot of wisdom that we don't want to lose as a field.
Yes, I agree. A few years ago, I went to a conference for outdoor and environmental educators, and there was one session that was all about coping skills, and not coping in the general way we think of coping skills, but coping how to stay in the field of environmental education. And so this was a huge brainstorming session of people in their 20s, very young, passionate, energetic individuals who were very good at what they did. I watched them work throughout that 2-day conference at the residential camp, and they were getting tired, and some of them looked more tired than others. You could see, and I had the sense that some of them were about to leave, and some of them had already left and had, you know, to get a real job. But they came back because they really like outdoor education, and that's what they used to do. And so they were attending the conference, and others were, you could just feel it. They were on their way out. And so how do you keep them? And how can they build a life that is not just seasonal work, you know, one short season here, one short season there. And, you know, I could relate to that because I used to be, you know, adjunct faculty way back when, and working, you know, your contracts are only one semester at a time. And that gets old, that gets tiring. It gets frustrating and discouraging.
Yeah, I think those are all really poignant points for the field right now. And honestly, as long as I've been in it, I've seen that, I've experienced moments of that as well. And I think, you know, the couple of things I've personally found that have helped me to guard against it, one is being really clear on why I do this, because it sure as heck isn't to become a millionaire. However, I absolutely love my work, and I speak with friends who bemoan their jobs and dread their Mondays, and you know, I feel like there's a piece of that fulfillment. But knowing really clearly for myself, what is my reason? What are my goals for the world? What is the vision that I seek? You know, and how can I put myself in service of that? It keeps me going, that larger vision, when I'm struggling or getting tired. And the other piece is, I think that I love hearing that there was a workshop you attended that was on coping skills, you know, and I think it's an important piece of how do we keep ourselves connected and hopeful and inspired? You know, what are our personal care strategies? What is it that we need to do that allows us to still be engaged and active? And, you know, is that time outside for ourselves? Is it nature journaling? Is it, you know, stepping away for a few weeks at a time and, you know, doing something else, and knowing that all of that's okay, because what this field is incredibly ripe with potential and inspiration, and it's also demanding. And so that self-care requirement is really something that I think I wish I had known that better as a beginning environmental educator instead of learning it the hard way.
What type of programming do you do? Well, let me back up. Humane education. As I mentioned earlier, I started to watch a video at a summit in which you participated. You were on a panel about self-care and wellness. What is humane education's role in environmental education? How do you blend that into your work?
That is a really, really good question. And I actually think humane education and environmental education are so closely related. And in fact, the humane education kind of network often has an environmental strand. And I would love to see the environmental education network start to have more of a humane strand. And that humane education is the focusing of empathy for other beings. And a lot of times you'll see humane educators come from, you know, animal shelters and places like that, where they're completely focused on that kind of education. But I think in environmental education, it's easy to think about big processes and, you know, looking at ecological kind of experiences from that removed place of, okay, here's how the water cycle works. Here's how the rock cycle works. You know, here's how to measure the pH balance of a stream. And I think where humane education has an interesting component to add is that it brings in the empathy. You know, it's okay to have empathy for the stream or empathy for that piece of grass or that animal or each other. And how do those build together? That overarching, really important knowledge of how it works on this planet and how we fit in with the heartfelt emotional connections that actually guide our actions. And really, at the end of the day, it's not our scientific knowledge that tells us how to act. That's really an important piece of helping us decide what to act. But it comes from our heart and our soul when we decide, oh my gosh, I'm gonna be, you know, active in my community in this way. You know, I'm concerned about this issue, or I'm really inspired by this piece of land and I want to lead the coalition to preserve it, or whatever it is that leads somebody to action. And so to me, the blending of humane and environmental education is about as natural as anything. You know, it's definitely, they go together well.
You are currently working on a PhD?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Through Antioch University in New England.
You are studying other than human relationships?
Yeah, my passionate interest is the larger question is how do we integrate the more than human voice into our day-to-day culture in the Western world? And I have also a specific interest in how does that work with environmental education? How do we invite those other voices? And however those voices is defined, whether that's people who are in a shamanic inclination and actually do communication with animals in nature, or whether it's a sense that people get, or even a deep understanding of what might be needed in a certain place. You know, how do we take into consideration that perspective and that voice of the more than human, or the non-human, or the other than human, however you want to phrase that? one concern I have with not just environmental ed, but with our world is that it's so human focused. And on the one hand, we're human animals. And so we certainly have a bias towards seeing the world through our lens, like every other being on the, you know, I'm sure my dog looks at the world through the lens of a dog, you know, or the nose of a dog, I should say, you know, but how can we be empathetic, sympathetic, and inclusive of the fact that we're sharing this planet with a lot of life. And a lot of that life probably has ideas, even if it's not ideas in the way that we have ideas, for what would be the best next action or move or decision. And so that's a fascinating place that I'm very excited about and looking forward to doing more research within.
How do you conduct research like that?
There is the golden question. I am currently designing my dissertation, and that is a huge piece of my question is what does this look like? Because we have to obviously operate from the human angle. But how do other people experience the non-human world? You know, what are the ways that people feel that they're in communication with? And so part of my research is actually going to be looking into that very question of just in the modern Western world, you know, what are all the ways? You know, I think that we can get very caught in certain ways or the only way or certain ways or woo-woo. And, you know, there's all kinds of baggage that can go with that. But at the same time, I've met so many people from so many walks of life who, when they hear that this is my interest, they have their stories of these, what they perceived as these deep, connective, communicative experiences with non-humans. And so part of what I want to do is collect those stories and let's, you know, let's honor that experience. And perhaps in that piece, we can start to let that be a little more the norm.
Are you familiar with the book Plants as Persons, A Philosophical Botany?
I have not read it, but I actually have heard that title. Yeah.
Yes. I reviewed the book 7 years ago, and it's fascinating. It is really very, very interesting. The author, Matthew Hall, his objective is to encourage humans to change the relationships with plants and to get them to thinking about plants in a different way. And so, you know, he wants people to stop thinking of plants as radical others and as being inferior to humans, and to begin thinking of them as other than humans, worthy of respect and moral consideration.
Boy, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. You know, and I think it's inappropriate and perhaps dangerous to look at other beings as either less than, or even in some cases, you know, in a reverent way where there's worship that removes us from being in a co-creative relationship with the world around us. I think what's really exciting to me is that, you know, we've evolved together. We're in this co-creative reality of living on this earth with all of its gifts and wonders and all of its challenges that, you know, we're in it together. And I think that conversation, I would love to see more of that conversation in environmental education in years to come.
Have you experienced any resistance to this different way of thinking? And what kind of feedback have you received?
Yes, there is definitely resistance. And I have a strong sense that as I go deeper into this work, I'll continue to meet, you know, I kind of have two reactions. One is very interested and sympathetic and people who are chomping at the bit to share their own stories and learn more. And then another side, which is, this is a really inappropriate and dangerous way for the field to focus. And, you know, that if we focus this way in environmental education, then we're out of K-12 schools, or we're not getting EPA funding, or all of these things. And I think all of it is true. And I think one of the beauties of environmental education is that it's a spectrum of interdisciplinary content and experience. And so I work across the spectrum. I work in government, with government organizations, and in my own private business. And I can tell you, when I'm doing a government program, I'm not saying the same things. You know, we're not talking about communication with trees with that kind of language versus if I'm doing a private workshop with a group that's hired me specifically because they want that. However, the deep connection and the personal reflection and the expressive relationship, all of those pieces can fit into all those areas. And so I very much think that environmental education is so profound and rich that it can hold it can hold this kind of work in the appropriate places and in the appropriate way. And I'm not the only one who thinks this. I mean, there's a lovely book that just came out a few months ago called Wild Pedagogies. And I'll be joining a research trip in August in Norway with some international scholars exploring this body of work, one piece of which is incorporating the more than human voice into education. And so there's a faction of people out there exploring this as well.
You've led workshops at the environmental ed conferences. What kind of workshops have you led?
Yeah, you know, the one that comes to mind is spirituality and environmental education, which I led there and then also at the statewide level and a few other places, which ended up actually turning into a published research paper on the topic. But what are the spiritual components of environmental education and how do we build that into our program? And that work was actually born out of environmental ed itself. You know, the first time I started really realizing I was early in my career, I was leading a nature hike on the natural history of black bears, you know, very, very specific topic. And I turned around and this woman was in tears. And I thought, oh my gosh, did she hurt herself? What happened? And I said, are you okay? She said, yeah, what you just said made me realize how much I have in common with bears. And I had never thought about that before. And I watched for the hike, I watched her worldview shifting and her starting to talk more about the mystery of life and the sense of connection and all these things that, and here I was very early in my career thinking, oh my gosh, I thought we were going to be talking about what bears eat to get ready for winter, you know, and I was totally underprepared. And that led to many years of research and presenting on this topic. And many other times in the field where I saw similar experiences where I thought, oh my gosh, you know, bringing people and the earth together is so powerful that as environmental educators, you know, we need to be prepared for the fact that for some people, this can be a really transformational experience, even if we think it's just part of our job and we're just leading this quick hike, you know. And so that body of work has been something that I've led at workshops or at conferences several times.
There's an ongoing conversation about making the field more diverse. Do you think that's some of the resistance you experience to your approach to nature education and connecting people to nature comes from the fact that the field isn't that diverse, that the outlook is from more of the dominant culture than a mix of cultures?
Yeah, you know, and when you put it that way, I think that you're exactly right. I think there are multiple ways of knowing. There are many cultural lineages that, you know, bring forward multiple ways of knowing. And, you know, I personally think that every person, if we trace our roots far enough back, we've got earth-based cultures in some way in our roots. And so with deep connection that did not include all of the really amazing and cool scientific discoveries and you know, nomenclature that we have today. And so I actually do think that if we go into the spiritual and emotional and expressive angles of environmental ed and we open ourselves to the idea that there are more voices than human, that might actually be a really powerful way for the field to become more inclusive. And I think that can get through language barriers, cultural barriers, religious barriers, all sorts of age group, generational. I mean, there's so many pieces that when it's this kind of a personal approach, I think, yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there could be individuals who don't see themselves, you know, in the field. And maybe if there was a different approach offered as a component of the field overall, they might say, hey, that resonates with me. You don't want to get involved with environmental education.
And it's funny you say that because part of the reason I struck out doing a lot of freelance work and starting my own business was because there were big parts of the field that I related to, but then there was this other work that I really felt called to do. But I wasn't able to do that in some of my consulting work with organizations, you know, and so I think you're exactly right. And I do think there's a lot of environmental education happening in this world that isn't being called that, but it's profound and it's making a difference for people and for their experience with the environment. And I totally agree with that.
And I think part of that is the word environmental is very dangerous.
Boy, that is true. You know, years ago I was on a committee in Colorado and we were working on, it was pre-environmental literacy plan, but we were trying to get an environmental education resolution passed through our Department of Education. And it did not pass. And the feedback we got was from a couple of people on that committee that they would not support it because of the word environmental. Even though the education and the components, you know, did not necessarily offend their sensibilities, it was that word, that loaded and hot word. And in fact, when we actually worked on our environmental literacy plan in Colorado, which I was the chairperson on that committee, we focused on place-based education for the purpose of trying to be as inclusive as possible and making sure that people knew that this wasn't what to think, it was how to think. It was an opportunity to explore. But yeah, so you're right. And spirituality is another word that's very loaded. So you put spiritual and environmental education together and it's going to shut some people down.
Yes, that's for sure. I was reading your explanation about place-based spiritual arts, and you mentioned that no matter where we are on the planet, wildlife and humans share the same sun, breathe the same air, and that sacred places exist literally everywhere. I live in Southern California. There's traffic everywhere. And so one of my first thoughts was, what is spiritual about gridlock traffic? Where do you find that when it takes you 3 hours to travel 80 miles?
That is a great question. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. That's actually my question. What is spiritual about gridlock traffic? How do you find sacred places in the mundane, everyday places?
Yeah, that is a huge passion of mine. You know, I think there's a lot of excitement and certainly merit in traveling to exotic places and, you know, going to Machu Picchu and having, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I have heard so many people over the years say, I need to get away. I need to renew. I need to rejuvenate. I need to connect to my spirituality. I hear these words and I think, oh my gosh, there's a dandelion growing in the crack in the sidewalk right outside the door. That is such an amazing expression of life and, you know, moving towards the sun and this plant that's here living right now in this place where you think it'd be really hard to be. And you know, sitting with that dandelion for 20 minutes could be a really profound thing. Or if you're sitting in traffic, you know, saying, okay, time to breathe. Let me just count how many birds go by as I'm sitting here. Or let me follow that cloud across the sky as I'm, you know, not moving my car at all because the traffic is so intense. You know, I remember one time being at an intersection where we were sitting there for many rounds of the light changing, and the swallows in the intersection were just diving and diving and going after insects. And the dance of these swallows and the swirling and the patterns, you know, it was stunning. And I thought, wow, if I hadn't been stuck here in this traffic at this intersection, I don't know that I would have taking the time to sit here and watch this. But ever since then, when I go to intersections, you know, certain times a year, I look for the swallows. Like, are they here? Are they, you know, are they coming after the insects? And it prompted me to want to go home and read more about what is it that attracts, you know, what. So then it became this investigation as well. And so it launched me into this thing that years later, one of my favorite things in the summer and spring is swallows in the intersections. And so I think it's kind of a way of looking at the world and saying, all right, nobody loves traffic. You know, I'd really like to be going through this. However, you know, I don't want to see people who can't afford to go to exotic places feeling like that they don't have a deep and sacred connection with the world around them. You know, I have a good friend who works for the city of Boulder, and she grew up in the Bronx, and I'll never forget. She told me once that she fell in love with the natural world because of the insects in her stairwell in her apartment building. And I was moved so much by that because, you know, she as a kid would go and sit and watch the insects crawling around the stairwell. And so that's wildness right there. You know, that's a wild kingdom right there in the middle of a concrete stairwell.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's a story.
Right. Yeah.
Tell us about your programs and the programs that you develop, many types of programs, and you work with individuals, you work with animals as well. You've been talking about your connections with people more. What about your connections with animals? What kind of work do you do with animals?
Yes, you know, again, spawning out of my time as a field environmental educator, I started to really become curious about our ability to communicate with other animals. Also, coming from a childhood where this was something that I did naturally, and then shut down for my teens and 20s because I was pretty convinced I had lost my marbles, because that was crazy, and my cultural, you know, voices in my head saying, you're nuts for doing this. What I've learned over the years, though, till now, is that it's a profound opportunity. For example, if a person has an animal companion, you know, to have animal communication opportunities, workshops where people are learning how to do that work on their own, it can really deepen their relationship, whether it's their companion dog or, you know, a wild place. You know, I've worked with people where they've come into a certain piece of land that they now are stewarding, and they wanted to deepen how they were interacting and what the land wanted from them, and how they should be on that land. And so I continue to be humbled by that work, because it's, you know, it's bigger than me. I feel like when I do that kind of work, those communication sessions and those workshops, it's, I feel like a messenger. And it's, I watch the experience of people and the animals just change and deepen. And it also is something that's really useful. I do work with rescue dogs and cats. And sometimes when animals come from very traumatic backgrounds and they're moving into rescue and becoming rehomed and all of those things, which are very stressful, it can be an added piece that can accompany, you know, very humane and positive training and medical care and all those things. But to have this kind of spiritual, emotional component from the animal's point of view can be really valuable in helping them move through their transitions and settle into their next chapter, you know, hopefully as smoothly as possible. I also think it helps people look at the world differently. You know, I've had many clients over the years who are very skeptical, but they were in a situation where they really just needed any help they could get. And, you know, the session, when it turned out helping them, one of my most motivating things someone can say to me is, wow, I will never look at my dog the same way again. It's different now. I understand differently.
How many years have you been doing your work?
Well, that kind of work, on the one hand, has been my entire life. On the other hand, in a professional setting through my business, Wild Rhythms, I believe that was 2003 that I started that. And then that's kind of morphed and ebbed and flowed over the years. It's, you know, very dynamic, and it changes as I change and as I learn more. But that kind of work has been kind of, I would say, probably 15 years. And in my mind, that's environmental education. That's where it gets funny, because it's about how do we live on this earth? How do we interact with other beings? You know, so to me, it all feels like that. It's all environmental ed. I realize that that might not be everybody's interpretation of animal communication, but
it is all an environmental education. No, absolutely is. How did you start Wild Rhythm? What was the impetus? What made you say, I'm going to do this now? And then what made you say, here, I made this? And then how did you begin to develop your network?
Yeah, great question. So I started it because I wanted a place. You know, I was working as an environmental educator, doing work that I loved, but I could feel that I wanted a place, like a container, if you will, to be able to do some of this work that was a little more spiritual, a little bit more edgy in some cases, you know, and that I just wouldn't be appropriate, like we've said earlier, it wouldn't be appropriate to do under certain organizational requirements, like government or nonprofits with a mission that was different. So it was the creative part of me that also was wanting to sort of play with my role in environmental ed. How can I push the edges? How can I be experimental and innovative with the field in a way that I don't get creatively stifled? So, okay, to do that, I have to start my own thing. All right, so let's do that. I named it Wild Rhythms. Honestly, that came to me. It was like a spark of insight, because I was thinking, what do I call it? Deb Matlock Consulting. It didn't feel right. And I literally heard a voice say Wild Rhythms. And I thought, oh, that's exactly it. I didn't understand what it meant at the time. It just felt right. I went down, and back then I actually went to the city building. You know, it wasn't so online. And I filed the paperwork with the state of Colorado and you know, made it official. And then I walked out and I thought, what in the heck is this that I just did? And then over the years, that's become, it was started out as a arts-based environmental education, and kind of moving from there into the more spiritual and into its current iteration, which is the place-based spiritual arts and the animal and nature communication, and a little bit more of the individual life coaching pieces that are near and dear to me now. In terms of the network, you know, that's an ongoing process. A lot of people are from within the environmental ed community, but one of the things that also excites me is finding the communities of people who are yearning for that sense of connection, you know, who feel that affinity but don't have the skills to explore it. And I think that that's something that I took for granted as an environmental educator, was that most people in the field can walk out on a trail and have an experience of some kind. But there are people who want that, but wouldn't know the first thing about starting a nature journal or even being outdoors in a way that was comfortable and safe. You know, so it, you know, part of me also likes to find those communities of people that are wanting to connect to that natural rhythm in their own lives and explore that. But again, who are not even thinking about environmental education.
When you reach out, are you finding people who are already wanting what you have? And how do you find those people?
You know, it's interesting, as I find in so many, it continues to surprise me, in so many different areas, walks of life, whether it's a, you know, business networking group or a, you know, male, female, it doesn't, you know, this yearning is there. This urge for connection is there. It may not always be something that somebody can articulate right away, but what I have found more often than not is when people say, oh, so what do you do? And I start saying, well, you know, I focus on sacred nature connection and animal communication. And they're like, oh, tell me more. So, you know, there's a lot of people for whom it strikes a chord. There are those that are like, oh, well, that's lovely. I actually left my coat. I got to go. And they, you know, they find another way out. But a whole lot of people from a whole lot of walks of life say to me, I want to talk to you further. And that to me is the exciting place. It's like, how can we all enliven this part of ourselves and support each other in this journey of being wild beings on this planet and knowing how we fit, you know, and knowing that it's not just us. Mm-hmm. So I actually think there's a swelling coming, you know, that this is important.
Mm-hmm. And so then, have you found an increased interest and a swelling as you describe it? Do you feel that there's been a correlation with the rise of technology and gadgets and all that?
I suspect that there is. You know, I don't have the data for sure from surveys or whatever, but I definitely think, I mean, I hear things from people like, I feel like I'm tied to my phone, or I'm stuck at my computer all day, you know, or wow, this is the first time I've seen the sky in 8 hours. You know, these sorts of things. So I would not be surprised if there's a sociologist or somebody out there doing that specific research, which I'm sure there are, that they're not finding that piece. You know, we talk a lot about it in environmental ed, about children and screen time and all that. But I think that the same is, you know, adults experience it as well. The challenge with us is that we have responsibilities that I think that it's harder in some cases for us to find those ways. And one of the things I love to do with folks is say, okay, so let's talk about your life and your daily routine and your schedule and all that. And how can we weave this in without it being one more thing on your already overfilled to-do list? But how can we weave it in so that when you're stuck in traffic, you're watching the birds, you know, like those little moments of rich quality that could change the way the day feels.
Your work then with people is more, you go to them and you work with them in their environment, or do you lead classes in very specific types of venues?
Yeah, I do a few different things. A lot of the work I do with individuals is actually on the phone, where then they go between our sessions together, they go out and have ways to explore their environment, and, you know, and then we kind of come back together, you know, every couple of weeks or whatever their situation is. With workshops, I offer workshops locally where I live in the foothills of Colorado, but also organizations will sometimes hire me to come and do a workshop in their location and maybe offer a presentation, you know, if they're doing a retreat of some kind. And so, and then, you know, sometimes I work with people individually. So if somebody wants a day-long retreat for themselves, you know, we can figure out the location based on where they are and where I am and all those logistics. What I really love is the empowered piece of how can I help people, even if I'm never going to be where they are, how can I help them so that when they go out, they are experiencing their place in a way that is just deeply connected.
When you work with people, either in a group or individually, what have you found wakes people up, makes them see above their own personal sea of noise? Is it the sight of something in nature? Is it something that you say? Is it sense of touch? Is it change of scenery? What have you found that is that one thing that begins to wake people up? And then from there, you can guide them further.
I think there's kind of two pieces to that. One is a rhythm, you know, so oftentimes, for example, if I'm leading a hike, people have driven to the trailhead and they've been on their phones and, you know, there's chaotic morning getting the kids out the door before, you know, so allowing the space to just slow down a little bit, I think is a really important, I mean, I know that I need that on a regular basis. It's very easy to get caught in this driving rhythm. So I think slowing the pace is very important. The other piece is leaving space for people to find what they are feeling most attracted, you know, whether it's they're really called to explore tree bark, you know, or they're really interested in the sky and the clouds. So I like to create space within the programs for some time off alone, you know, even if it's alone standing in a group, just what's calling your attention and, you know, why does that interest you? Do you have something in common with that tree or with that cloud? Or is it that it's beautiful? You know, and allowing them to focus themselves to what's inspiring to them then allows, it's like a door opens in a way where then it's like, they're not worried about, oh, well, I didn't have the right name for that plant, so therefore I'm not connected to this landscape, you know, to simplify. But, oh, it's okay that I feel pulled towards the clouds and not the wildflowers, even though it's a wildflower hike. That's okay. You know, and that's kind of that teachable moment idea, but on a very personal level of just letting knowing that my role ultimately as an environmental educator, as a facilitator of experience, and that the earth is really doing the teaching, which once I figured that out, it made, first of all, the job a lot easier, but I started realizing the programs were a lot more, and not that I don't bring facts or information, but that realizing I needed to keep space in all the programs for the person in the earth and for me to get out of the way, you know, really, really was an important understanding when that finally came in my process.
What would you like people to know and understand about place-based spiritual arts? What's the first thing you'd help them understand?
Oh, that this is innate in all of us. This is, you know, every single one of us in whatever color and flavor and way that we interact with the world can have a sense of place-based spirituality. You know, it doesn't fight with religion. It doesn't. It's not a belief system. It's just an experience. It's just looking at that dandelion in the sidewalk and letting it mean more than, oh, just a dandelion in the sidewalk. And for some people that can be very tied to a certain religion. And for others, it can just be a moment of, wow, I don't know if I could grow in that sidewalk, you know? And for others, it could be, wow, what a beautiful bright yellow flower that is, you know? But just letting that moment be there, it's available to all of us. It doesn't cost money. It doesn't require a huge amount of study and preparation. You know, it doesn't mean we have to leave our communities, our homes, our routines, our lives. Those are all great things, but it doesn't mean that we can still do these sorts of moments. We can know where the bird nests are outside of our office buildings, with just seconds a day of paying attention to where we hear the noise and where we see the flight patterns. And, you know, we can engage in our places. And that is reciprocal. It benefits us. And I actually really believe it benefits the places and the wildlife as well.
What's next for you?
I love those kind of questions. The very first thing on my plate is I want to finish my dissertation exploring the more than human voice in our culture and in our education programs. And after that, I want to take that work and wherever it leads me, you know, I want to present on that, write on that, offer more retreats and workshops on that. And really, I feel like part of my mission is to help to bring that conversation into more of our mainstream conversations, and just let it be okay for people so that it's not people pulling me aside after a presentation and saying, oh, can I tell you about this experience? But yet we're more comfortable sharing that with each other and letting it become more of the norm. I mean, that's a bigger vision than one person. And like I said, I'm not the only one with that vision, but that's where I see my work going. The other thing with environmental ed is I feel like it's a career path that has guided me. So I'm also very open for what that next step also might look like, you know, what shows up. It's an organic career path in my experience, so.
Thank you, Deb, for your time today. Is there anything that you'd like to say that I didn't ask or that you would like to tell listeners?
I mean, first, I want to say thank you for exploring the freelance education phenomenon. I think it's a really important part of environmental ed. It's a place where a lot of innovation and creativity can happen within the field. Mm-hmm. And it also allows environmental ed to reach wider audiences. You know, if people are in communities, they can go do work with all kinds of different groups that maybe there isn't a nature center or something nearby. And it's also something I would want to say to listeners, if somebody's considering becoming a freelance environmental educator, I would say go for it. You know, it's a creative process, you know, it's not necessarily going to bring millions of dollars, but I don't see why it couldn't. And it's one of those things that really allows us as individuals who are called to this work to say, okay, what is my offering? You know, how can I really contribute to the field? How can I really make a difference? You know, what is the unique way that I do it? You know, that, like you were saying, your work with plants, I mean, what is that place where my heart comes alive and I feel very inspired to share? And I recommend a lot of folks, even if they have other jobs as well, to do this because of all of those reasons. And I know it's one of the things that's helped me with longevity in the field, because it's something that I can keep recreating and keep myself inspired too. So the field needs it. So go for it, everybody.
To learn more about Deb's research and to view the resources she's sharing with listeners, visit the show notes for this episode at talaterra.com.